Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. It is hard to know where to look first with all the things in the news coming out of Washington and beyond. We will spend some time later in the program taking a kind of deep dive into Steve Bannon, who he is, what his worldview really is, what his influence is turning out to be in these first 2 weeks of the Trump presidency. But first, let's talk about the Democrats in Congress. They are scrambling to figure out how to act and who they are with Donald Trump as president, and that is changing day to day. Now, shortly after the election, Bernie Sanders came on this show, and I asked him about refusing to normalize Trump by doing business with him at all, as some of our callers were asking that the Democrats do. Sanders was in a different place.
Now, one of the things that we are going to do is to research, and we're doing it right now, every bloody statement that Donald Trump made during his campaign, every promise that he made about all of the things that he wants to do. And you know what? We're going to hold him accountable. He talked about taking on Wall Street. He talked about protecting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. He talked about rebuilding the infrastructure. He talked about being a quote-unquote champion of the working class. We are going to hold him accountable, and we're going to bring people together to demand that when he speaks about the needs of working families, when he speaks about the needs of high unemployment rates in minority communities, that he actually fulfills what he said. But the bottom line is, again, for me, the only way we succeed is when our people come together. And when we do, we are going to win this thing.
Senator Bernie Sanders on this show in November. And give me another minute to set up this idea, folks, because it was the same with Chuck Schumer, New York senior senator, of course, and the leader of all Senate Democrats after the retirement of Harry Reid. Here's what he said on network television shortly after the election.
Surprisingly, on several different issues, Donald Trump and his campaign echoed the views of Democrats, not Republicans. Massive transportation bill, trade, getting rid of the carried interest loophole, cleaning up the swamp. And on those issues where he agrees with us and the Republican establishment and hard right doesn't, we challenge him. Work with us. And keep your promises to blue-collar America. I think blue-collar America voted for Donald Trump more on Democratic issues than on Republican issues, which he professed. And we will work with him on those issues.
Rework NAFTA?
Absolutely.
Kill the Pacific Trade Partnership, which seems like it's
gone already, but I'm glad it is. I opposed it.
Paid maternity leave.
We should work out something that's strong and good, but I'm open to it.
Schumer on Fox News Sunday in November. But grassroots pressure on congressional Democrats is forcing them to change their tune. You know about the big turnout, obviously, for the women's marches and the spontaneous protests Saturday over the travel ban at JFK and elsewhere. Also, a reported 3,000 to 5,000 people gathered this week in front of Schumer's Brooklyn apartment building to demand stiffer resistance to the Trump agenda and Trump nominees.
Filibuster every bill, filibuster everything.
Filibuster everything.
That's some sound from that protest in front of Schumer's apartment. Filibuster every bill, filibuster everything. And it's not just Schumer. USA Today has an article this morning that catalogs some of the other pressure. It says Pennsylvania's Democratic Senator Bob Casey has gotten 80,000 angry letters and other correspondence about Betsy DeVos alone, Trump's education secretary nominee. Two Republican senators have now come out against DeVos, and her nomination is hanging by a thread. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, maybe the most conservative Democrat in the Senate, got 800 phone calls about the seven-country travel ban, 97% of the calls opposing it. The ACLU got $24 million in donations in a single weekend, six times what it typically raises in an entire year, USA Today reports. The ACLU, of course, won that federal court stay on part of the travel ban Saturday night. Protest leaders are trying to institutionalize weekly demonstrations as well, being called Resist Trump Tuesdays. Those are just some examples. So Democrats have started singing a different tune. from what Bernie Sanders said here early on. Senate Democrats boycotted the confirmation votes on Trump's Treasury, Health, Human Services, and EPA nominees this week rather than show up and vote no, even. And here is Democratic strategist David Brock on Morning Edition today with Steve Inskeep.
When Republicans turned against President Obama, they were labeled the party of no.
Right.
Do you want Democrats to be the party of no?
I do. I mean, if we are, quote, obstructing, we're obstructing for the values of the majority of the country as expressed actually in this election and for working families, not for corporations. And so I'm not afraid of that label.
David Brock on Morning Edition. Senate Democrats are now discussing whether to filibuster the Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. But is all this the best strategy for a party that not only lost the electoral vote for president, but is getting decimated in congressional, gubernatorial, and state legislative races increasingly in every election this decade? So Democratic listeners, help us report this story. How have you been making your voice heard in ways you weren't before the election? Have you contacted any of your senators or members of Congress from where you live or from not where you live? And how should your party most effectively fight the Trump agenda? 212-433-WNYC, or at least those parts of the Trump agenda that you object to. 212-433-9692. Should the party do business on those areas like Chuck Schumer and Bernie Sanders laid out just after the election, where they might find common ground? 212-433-9692. Some people's answers to that question, which we have asked before, is changing. Democratic listeners, help us report this story. How have you been making your voice heard in ways you weren't before the election? And how should your party most effectively fight the Trump agenda? 212-433-9692. And with me now is USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, great to be with you again.
So I have those examples from the article in your paper today that I read. Are Democrats in Washington being pushed by the intensity of their base to a position they didn't expect to be on February 2nd?
That's exactly right. And, you know, it reflects it's actually a continuation of what we've seen happen for more than a year. Bernie Sanders' unexpectedly successful bid for the presidential nomination, not that he won the nomination, but he came so much closer than had been expected by Democrats and Democratic leaders at the point he started, was a reflection of the fact that the grassroots are in a more aggressive mood than the leadership has been. And that's certainly been true since Donald Trump won the presidency. You did see the initial idea that maybe they could put a wedge between Trump and congressional Republicans by focusing things on things like a big infrastructure bill. But that's not the mood of their voters, of Democratic voters. And it's been interesting to see these last two weekends of massive demonstrations against the new president have not reflected the efforts of the Democratic National Committee or Democratic leaders. These have been efforts by individual citizens, grassroots groups, advocacy groups, and the members of the Democratic leaders here in Washington and members of Congress are hearing this and adjusting, I think, their approach to the new president.
Can you explain the confirmation hearing boycotts? Who didn't show up for what and with what intent?
Well, this was one committee that was considering two nominees that Democrats say had not been honest in their previous testimony, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, and Tom Price, the nominee to head Health and Human Services. And under the rules of the committee, you had to have at least one person from each party at the hearing to have a vote. All the Democrats stayed away, led by Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon. They succeeded in stalling the vote for a day, but then there was other provisions of the rules that Republicans found that allowed them to suspend that provision, and they went ahead and had the vote yesterday, even though there weren't any Democrats in the room. You know, here's the situation that Democrats face. There are going to be very few situations in which they can actually stop action. They can't pass anything. It's very hard for them to block anything unless they turn to the filibuster. But they can muck up the works. They can slow things down, and that's what we've been seeing on the confirmation hearings this week.
And can you explain what's happening with Betsy DeVos?
Well, Betsy DeVos is on the cusp of being the only major Trump nominee who may go down in the confirmation process. She's not there yet. She's kind of hanging by a thread. She had the defection of two Republican senators, both of them women, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, yesterday, who said that they were too distressed by her lack of experience, her lack of knowledge when it comes to public education to vote for her. They said they'd heard from a lot of constituents. Now, Betsy DeVos, I think, is probably still going to get confirmed, but they're going to bring up her confirmation before Jeff Sessions, the attorney general nominee, because they need Sessions to vote as a senator in order to get a tie vote that then Mike Pence, the vice president, would be able to break. Huh. So she is in a very precarious situation. You know, even in the cases where nominees are getting confirmed, for instance, we saw the Secretary of State confirmed yesterday. He had 43 votes against him. And in the history of the United States, a Secretary of State has had a maximum of 14 votes against him. So They didn't defeat the Secretary of State, but we shouldn't miss the fact that this has become really huge battles, huge partisan battles in a way that are out of step with kind of our tradition, especially when it comes to a job like Secretary of State.
So people are calling in. We'll get to some of your phone calls, folks, in just a second. People are also tweeting at Brian Lehrer with their response to my question of what you've done since the election that maybe you've never done before with respect to political activity. And if you're a Democrat, what do you want your party to do now, especially in Congress? Do business, oppose in a blanket way, even on bills that you might support to help them get through if the old line Republicans oppose some of the things. What do you want your party to do now in general? So somebody tweets at us, Susan, can't the Dems do both, be the party of no for anything that stinks, simultaneously push progressive agenda and hold Trump to it, meaning hold Trump to it when he took those positions in the campaign?
Well, I guess you could do that, although, you know, there is I think if you're opposing Trump on everything and defying congressional Republicans on everything and trying to slow down even confirmation battles, you know you're going to lose. It doesn't exactly build the foundation for cooperative action on the things that you agree with. You know, it's like people are human beings, even in Washington. So you could try to do that. But Donald Trump also, I think, is a president who holds a grudge. I think we're seeing that play out even in his conversations with foreign leaders and in the tweets. And even in his comments this morning at the National Prayer Breakfast, which were quite remarkable, I think if you're defying him, if you're the party of no, it may be hard to get to a place of cooperation on the issues on which you agree. But sure, if there's a big infrastructure bill, maybe that's a place in which Democrats would be in agreement with the White House. Although we ought to note, even on the infrastructure bill, which is the big proposal that is most often cited as an example where there might be cooperation, there is a huge divide between how the White House and Democrats would pay for it. And it's not clear that divide would be possible to be met in the middle.
Ryan in Clark, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Ryan, thanks a lot for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me. So you asked about – so I'm a Bernie-style liberal Democrat, and I was always inactive. And Trump – if there is one good thing that can be had for Trump, people are getting active. So I first wanted to give a quick shout-out to 5calls.org. It is a fantastic little website that lets you organize what matters to you, and it helps you access the people that are important decision-making on that.
Okay.
But you also had a point about do we want the Democratic Party to be the party of no? And you're saying, well, maybe we don't because look how badly the Democrats are doing. But my counterpoint is the Republicans have been the party of no, and look how well they're doing. Maybe the Democratic Party needs to take a stand, a bold stand, and that might, you know, empower their voter base.
Ryan, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it. Susan, and my guest is Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Why has DeVos become the focal point out of all the controversial nominees? Her main issue, vouchers for private school, is a uniform Republican position that Trump himself campaigned on. I could argue that Jeff Sessions, with his racial record, Scott Pruitt, the EPA nominee, with his climate change denying, and maybe a couple of others, are really more radical, fringy, and more dangerous from a Democrat's point of view. And maybe one of them should have been the focal point to try to pick somebody off, because it looks like maybe if they marshal their forces, they can pick off one person. But it seems to be Betsy DeVos. I'm surprised it's not Jeff Sessions, frankly.
Well, one reason is because Betsy DeVos had a really tough time at the hearing that was held before the Senate committee. She didn't seem informed on some issues. She made that comments about that you might need guns in schools because of, what did she say, bears, which didn't seem quite to the point to many of the senators. She has never worked in a public school. None of her children have ever attended a public school. But the reality is Democrats are pretty much united against several of these nominees, but they've got to get some Republican votes to have a chance of keeping them from being confirmed. Remember that under the rules that Harry Reid imposed in 2013 when he did a limited nuclear option, it means they only need to get a majority vote to confirm anybody except a Supreme Court nominee, which means that that even if Democrats are united, they still need to get a couple Republicans to go with them defeat a confirmation. And it just happens that in this case, there were two Republican senators, both of them female, I might note, who were willing to defy their party and oppose him. You know, one other thing about what Ryan said about what works in politics, mm-hmm. being the party of no has definitely worked for Republicans in ginning up their core supporters. And we saw the kind of turnout with Republicans and with independents and some Democrats who politically agreed with what Donald Trump was saying, turnout last year. But being the party of no does not work with people who tend to be in the middle and who are the people who are kind of most distressed by the dysfunction that they see in Washington. So that's part of the calculation, I think, that polls are making on the Democratic side. And the traditional calculation has been you better do things that are going to appeal to folks in the middle who aren't fervently for you but sometimes vote one way and sometimes vote the other. But I got to say, I think that is changing, and it looks to me like we're going to have a party of no strategy here for the next 2 years.
And in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ann.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
I'm so grateful to you for having this conversation today. It's really, really important that we mobilize as we're galvanizing our energies. I was actually at the Schumer rally this past week, and I think that one of the things that people are really looking to do is inform the senators of their actual job and their duty. And one of the ways to do that is to kind of remind them of the oath that they took to defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I think that that's a message that a lot of people want to send. I think that there's a lot of energy directed toward people entering politics through brand new Congress. And the Young Turks are now forming a new political movement. I think that more and more people are starting to realize that they have not just a duty to inform elected officials what their job is and what they are working towards, but they're also starting to step into the ring and become politicians themselves.
The Young Turks, by the way, have been around for so long now that they're in their 40s. But I guess compared to Trump and Schumer, they're still the Young Turks. And how did that Schumer rally turn out to your eyes since you were there? Because a press account that I read said that it turned from a protest against Schumer into a rally when he addressed the crowd and seemed to show some spine by saying he was going to vote against 8 Trump nominees.
I think that the intention might have felt a little bit like a rally. I think that people were very excited. You know, it's an exciting thing when you actually get an immediate response to someone whom you're trying to get the attention of.
Mm-hmm.
I did not get the feeling that people were at all convinced, the people whom I was on the ground with. They felt that that was that the results were not going to be satisfactory.
And I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. By the way, Susan Page, you mentioned before remarkable comments by Trump at the National Prayer Breakfast this morning. Was that when he said he would pray for Arnold Schwarzenegger to get good ratings as the new host of Celebrity Apprentice, or was it something else?
Yes, I thought that was not the traditional approach that presidents have taken at the National Prayer Breakfast, which is one of the diminishing number of bipartisan events that are held in this town and are usually focused on religious issues. So the idea that he would say that was I think surprising. He also defended himself from some negative against some stories this morning that talked about rocky starts in his conversations with foreign leaders. He said that when you hear about, let's see, I wrote it down, when you hear about tough phone calls, don't worry about it. You know, there's a report on the front page of the Washington Post this morning that says he had a curtailed phone conversation with the Prime Minister of Australia, one of our closest allies, that ended very badly over whether the United States would live up to a existing agreement to take 1,250 refugees from an Australian island. He also said that he was going to get rid of the Johnson Amendment. Now, this isn't a new position he's taken, but it was interesting that he chose this moment to announce he was going to totally get rid of it. This is a provision of the tax code that prevents churches from taking positions in political races.
Amy in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you, Brian?
Good,
thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to challenge the assumption that, like similar to the tweet that you read early on in the segment, that the opposition to unqualified nominees is the same as just obstructing the process and refusing to compromise. I think Democrats would come together if some of these nominees demonstrated more relevant qualifications. In the case of Betsy DeVos, less potential for racism. In the case of Jeff Sessions, more less obvious potential for racism, as evidenced by Coretta Scott King's letter and the 1986 Senate hearings. You know, that's not the same thing as failing to come together on maternity leave or infrastructure or the TPP, which Bernie Sanders did come out and say after Trump had nixed it. Bernie Sanders, you may remember, came out and said,
said
that he was for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but that's the do business position. Or, Susan, let's address this one more time. Are they necessarily in conflict? Or if there is a parental leave bill, as Amy cites, or some other things on trade or whatever they might be that are part of the Democratic agenda that Republicans in Congress have tended to oppose, where Trump kind of crosses that line, if these things come up, does being the party of no really mean that Democrats have to block those just so Trump doesn't have any successes?
Well, you know, actually, Democrats have in some cases come united pretty much behind Trump nominees they like. General Mattis would maybe be the best example of that, who's now the Secretary of Defense. It was an 81-17 vote to confirm him in the Senate, and some of the votes against him were based not on opposition to Mattis, but on to the fact that he required a waiver on the rule that you have to be out of the military for 7 years to serve as Secretary of Defense. So the Democrats, I think, were actually kind of relieved to have General Mattis in that role because they think they have experience with him, they think highly of him. So otherwise,
Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon are running foreign policy. You know your administration is out there when the one with the nickname Mad Dog is the level-headed one.
That's right. So Democrats are making some of those calculations, but I take Amy's point. You want to oppose. Here's the thing: you want to oppose the things that you think are most egregious and most important, because you probably can't wage every battle every day on every front. So one of the things that Democrats are, I think, in Washington are now trying to figure out is where are the things on which they're going to really stake their claim and make their most fervent opposition. And we'll see. Maybe we'll see on the Supreme Court nomination whether they Democrats decide to hold pretty solid and try to filibuster it. Although with the knowledge that Mitch McConnell's made it pretty clear that if they do that, he'll explode his own nuclear option that gets you back to just a majority vote, even for a Supreme Court nominee.
And I guess that's the real choice, is just be the party of no and turn your backs on everything, or find a way to pick your battles and maybe try to win a few that way. Amy, let me just ask you one other thing, because the language you used at the beginning of your call was it's not being the party of no to oppose unqualified nominees.
Yeah.
What about the Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, who, of course, is very conservative in a Scalia sense, but people are saying he's very qualified? Do you think they should go to the mat?
That's a really good point, and I haven't actually made a decision. I'm looking to you and other reputable news sources, you know, along with my progressive counterparts, to kind of help me sort that through. I really appreciate your guest point about General Mattis. I should have mentioned him early on. I have a brother in the military who heavily supports the presence of General Mattis on the cabinet as Secretary of Defense. But, you know, when you look at nominees who have no experience in the field that they have been appointed to, Scott Pruitt is the EPA guy. Is that
That's right, EPA.
And no environmental or science experience or understanding at all, except for having sued the EPA. I mean, that's a little weird, right? Betsy DeVos never was a teacher. I work in education. Let me tell you something. Teachers don't play. I don't play with that. That doesn't make sense, you know? And
I hear you.
You know, I didn't make a decision on General Mattis right away. I consulted my brother. I read a lot about him. I thought about his positions and his language, both problematic and affirming. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he said some things that I don't agree with, but I was willing to listen to him, and I'm willing to listen to Republican ideas and my progressive friends and counterparts about the Supreme Court nominee as well.
Amy, thank you so much. Please call us again. So on Neil Gorsuch for Supreme Court, as it turns out, one of our local senators is on the Judiciary Committee, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. And on Morning Edition today, he raised questions about whether Judge Gorsuch is mainstream enough to win his vote.
The mainstream is, for example, a respect for well-established precedent, a case like Roe v. Wade, which has numerous progeny or cases that follow it. A mainstream thinker also puts individual rights ahead of corporate interests. A mainstream thinker is a unifier, a moderate, someone who will keep the executive branch in check, which is required particularly at a time when this chief executive, Donald Trump, is doing so much that raises severe constitutional questions. And in my view, a mainstream thinker would rule unconstitutional these orders that have been issued that ban Muslims from coming into this country. Four judges already have stayed the orders.
That is Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal on Morning Edition today. My guest for another few minutes is Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Susan, there's a Gorsuch factoid that's starting to go around social media. The Daily Mail in the UK reported that while Gorsuch was a high school student at Georgetown Prep High School in D.C., he started a club called the Fascism Forever Club. And quoting from the Daily Mail here, the yearbook described, because they got this from his high school yearbook, the yearbook described the Fascism Forever Club as an anti-faculty student group that battled against the liberal views of the school administration. Have you heard of this yet? Can you confirm it? And if so, what do you think the implications of it might be?
So I haven't heard of it before. This is the first I've heard of it. I can't confirm it. I think Fascism Forever is probably not the good name for a good name for a group formed by somebody who aspires to the Supreme Court. But hard for me to know much about it. In fact, I don't know anything about it.
It's as described, he was using the word fascism to refer to liberal teachers maybe trying to enforce their views, and that it was sarcastic. But I don't know.
But and you know what? If this in fact is true, I can guarantee you he'll be asked about it at his confirmation hearings, and he'll also be asked about some of the issues that Senator Blumenthal raises. Although the history of these Supreme Court hearings means issues that are currently working their way through the court, generally nominees decline to engage in a serious discussion of them. But we'll see. These are the Muslim ban, the travel ban, the future of Roe v. Wade. These are definitely issues at the top of people's minds when they think about this Supreme Court battle, but especially if there's a second Supreme Court nominee by Donald Trump for one of the seats now held by one of the more liberal justices.
By the way, is there any polling yet to see how Trump is doing among swing voters he won? Is he being seen as a change agent and getting cheered on for this confrontational style and, you know, no business as usual, or turning people off and being seen more as what Democrats want them to be seen as, these actions, you know, extreme and bullying and with too much sneering? I gather you're putting together a focus group.
Well, what we've done is we took 25 Trump voters. So in the final poll, the poll we took with the USA Today Suffolk University poll that we took right after the election, we formed just a kind of little, it's like a focus group, except they're people across the country, 25 Trump voters, just random people, not activists. Some of them are pretty fervently conservative, and some of them are more in the middle. So kind of a range of people. And we're going to just check in with them occasionally to see how they think Trump is doing. And today, in today's paper, we have the first kind of temperature taking of this group. And I can tell you that there were two that strongly supportive of the things he's done so far. They like the fact he's taking a lot of quick action. They point out that he's taking positions in office that he said he was going to take during the campaign. That's certainly true. But we also found, when we said, is there anything you don't like, the one thing that came up over and over again with these voters, these Trump voters, were they didn't like the tweeting. They didn't like the aggressive tweeting, the combative tweeting, the picking on every fight, taking offense at every slight. Any number of them, a significant number of them, said that they thought President Trump should cut that out, that it's part of adjusting to the job of being president. But when we said, do you approve or disapprove of the job Donald Trump has done so far as president, 25 of the 25 approve.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, how Governor Cuomo and some members of the New York State Legislature are starting to plan to try to resist the Trump agenda at the state level. We'll talk to State Senator Richard Gottfried, who has a bill to establish a New York State health insurance system if the Affordable Care Act goes away. Stay with us.